Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hey, it's Nick from True Crime Garage, and you're listening to this great show, so you obviously love true crime podcasts. Well, Stitcher's hosting True Crime Week, where they're showcasing the creepiest and most gruesome true crime podcasts, including ours. Download the Stitcher app and check out their curated homepage to find your next true crime podcast obsession. And don't forget, Stitcher's the only place to listen to our older archive episodes. And if you sign up for Stitcher Premium, you'll get access to our bonus episodes too. So go to StitcherPremium.com and sign up with the code GARAGE and go check out True Crime Week. Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man who has been sentenced to solitary confinement behind the glass in the garage studio engineer's room. He is our captain.
Yeah, so if I'm not making any sense, you know why. And it's good to be seen, and it's good to see you, and I'm telling you, I'm tired of the bologna sandwiches. Thanks for listening, and thanks for telling a friend.
Today we are slow sipping with happiness a delicious double porter called Bonfire from Napa Smith. Bonfire is a beautiful black color with a little caramel sweetness with roasted malt flavors that goes down silky smooth garage grade 3 3/4 bottle caps out of 5. And here we go and give praise and cheers to our good friends. First up, praise and cheers to Anthony in Craig, Colorado.
And a big special I love your jib.
Big thank you.
To Michelle in Baltimore, Maryland.
Next up, we have Mary Bell in Paris, California.
And a big cheers to Sarah in Springfield, Illinois.
Next up, Captain, we have my man Sean in Boulder, Colorado, who says, with each episode, he can feel his jib getting bigger. And last but certainly not
flicky,
least.
Flicky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Last but certainly not least, Captain, we have Mark in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Thank you all for contributing to this week's Beer Fund. If you want to help us out with next week's set of shows, go to truecrimegarage.com, click on the donate button, or check out the show page and support your local garage true crime podcast.
Yeah, and please write to your local congressperson to free me. Free me from my solitary confinement.
Save the captain.
Please. There's nothing to do. Everybody's staring at me.
Forget about saving the captain.
I have no pants on.
Just go to iTunes and leave us some stars. We need your stars.
5 stars.
Please.
Upon
all 5 of them. And that is enough of the business. Everybody gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. Where we left off yesterday, Captain, they had just found missing Ray Rivera's body inside the Belvedere Hotel, which is now primarily being used for condominiums. And he has crashed through the roof. We still do not know for what reason. And his lifeless body is found inside the building. Now, Ray had multiple injuries, including lacerations, fractured ribs, punctured lungs, of course, suggesting that he had fallen from a height into this room. Some of Ray's injuries are stated to be consistent with a fall, while others are stated not to be. And in particular, they cite his tibias being fractured. The medical examiner will go on record saying that this does not seem to be consistent with a fall.
That would be your shins.
Correct. Also found, we have Ray's flip-flops that were found on the roof near the hole that he crashed through. One broken and one with fresh drag marks. Ray's glasses are found, and they appear to be in good shape. His cell phone is found. The phone has scratches on it, but it is not broken. It's in working order. Ray's money clip, which was an engraved wedding gift from Allison that she and his brother say he always carried with him. They do not find this on Ray's person or on the rooftop. Other than that, it seems pretty consistent that what Allison and others believe he would have left with him that day, taken with him when he left the house that day, everything was found on him, with him, or on the rooftop.
And I'm assuming they never found the money clip back out of his house or anything.
Right. This was not found on him. It's never been located at all. I think it'd be something that would be completely washed away from the story had it been recovered. Okay, so the problem with a lot of this is the hole itself and where Ray is found. According to Unsolved Mysteries, there were three possible places from which Ray could have jumped or maybe been pushed from to end up going, creating that hole, and then crashing down into that unoccupied room.
And for people who haven't seen the episode, I'm going to post all these pictures. There's a bunch of pictures of the actual hotel or condo complex, whatever you want to call it, and a bunch of different angles and a rooftop view and even some measurements that people have taken. I'll post all of those to our Instagram. That's at True Crime Garage. Follow us on Instagram.
This is where it gets difficult that we are simply audio and there's no video to go along with it, because I think, you know, we're going to do our best to tell the story and paint the picture for you.
Well, people keep requesting audio because you're so handsome, but I keep breaking the
cameras. You mean video?
Yeah.
So as police began to analyze this case, numerous aspects seemed odd about Ray Rivera jumping off of the main roof of the Belvedere Hotel. This is partly due to where the location of the hole is in the lower roof. There was a considerable horizontal distance between the hotel tower and the location of the hole in the lower roof. So I think the way to go about this here, Captain, because we have these three different spots that Unsolved Mysteries says he could have come from to end up going through that hole in the roof. And that's a weird way of saying it, to go through that hole in the roof. It makes it sound like the hole was already there.
Right.
Unfortunately, his body created that hole. But I think you have to say it that way because it's really the placement of the hole as far as a distance goes from the surrounding above areas to get to that spot that makes it seem mathematically difficult.
Right.
And that, again, is a big part of the mystery of why did he end up there and how did he end up where we found him. So the first one that I think we should discuss would be the parking garage, because this one seems to be the most easily explained away as, no, it seems like this is the least likely of these three spots that he could have come from.
Yeah, possibly.
Right. So the way that this works is that the parking garage, the top of it, is the measurements are about 20 feet higher than the lower roof that he crashed through. And the spot, the hole in the roof, is about 20 feet out. the detective that initially looked at this case, he's on record saying, I don't think that that is a high enough distance to create an impact that one would even kill a man, or two would cause him to crash through the ceiling. So I'm going to go with that detective's assessment of that angle there from the top of the parking garage.
Well, let's go with the suicide angle as well. It'd be a pretty far distance for somebody to run and try to jump.
Yes, it would be, but I think that there would be... Okay, so I think that there's a problem with the distance of the upper rooftop of the Belvedere, more so than the distance traveled to make it to that spot on the lower roof from the parking garage. It's only 20 feet out. What he's saying is that if Ray would have jumped from the parking garage, he likely would have survived the jump.
Right.
And let's say... The other problem is he did create a hole in the ceiling and go through. The detective is saying he would have survived it and or not have had a great enough impact to crash through the ceiling.
What I've heard, and since we're starting with the parking garage, one idea that I find very interesting, or a theory that I find very interesting, is, well, could you get there and could you create an impact if the... you know, the velocity was stronger than somebody throwing you or jumping, as maybe he was hit by a vehicle or thrown from a vehicle.
That's an interesting question.
Because what you have to account to, if you go, well, he jumped. Okay, well, do you know how hard it is to jump when your both of your shins are broken?
If, in fact, the fall didn't create the break...
Well, the doctors are saying they didn't.
They say inconsistent.
Right. So,
which is not the same as impossible.
Right. But again, nothing's impossible. He could have, you know, aliens could have thrown him from the sky for all we know. But I'm going to go with the doctors and say this injury happened beforehand. Okay. What would hit you around the shins? Well, certain cars' bumpers possibly could hit you. So is it a situation where he's going to meet somebody up, and when he met them up, did they have baseball bats, or did they hit him with a car, and then was he on top of the car, and then they drove him really fast to the edge and hit the brakes? Is that a possibility?
You just said aliens could have put him there, so I don't know. I don't know how to go about this. There is a wall. I mean, it's not like a straight ledge that you would go off of, or that if a vehicle hit you, that you would just be essentially shot out of a cannon and fired to that spot on the roof. So I think it gets a little difficult of, okay, you just said that it would be very difficult for him to get there jumping wise 20 feet out. It also seems possibly even more difficult to get to throw him out that far.
Yeah. Like two people throwing
a 6'5", 260-pound man that does not want to go over a ledge.
Yeah.
You manage to catapult him out 20 feet. Now, I get what you're saying about the distance traveled seems to be difficult, and everybody agrees with that. The reason why I'm kind of glossing over that and moving to the next part is because if he were to go from the rooftop, the distance traveled horizontally would be even more. Now, granted, he would have a further distance of falling to get out that far.
Mm-hmm.
They do say that it's scientifically possible. It's not impossible that he couldn't have got himself all the way out there. So the way that that works is we just talk 20 feet out if he were to jump or get shot or however from the top of the parking garage over to the rooftop where he crashed through. The horizontal distance from the rooftop all the way up, one of the other options, is estimated at 40 to 43 feet.
So almost double the distance.
Correct. So they brought in some engineers to see if this is even possible, and they estimate that somebody traveling at a speed of 10 or 11 miles per hour could, in fact, make it all the way out that far. Now you have to factor in a few different things, right? One, could he even get up to a speed on foot of 10 to 11 miles per hour? Most people put that as a fast jog or sprint for the average fit male. This would be, you know, again, wearing sports shoes. This guy's wearing flip-flops. One of them ends up broken. But yeah, it's estimated that somebody could get up to that speed.
Well, they could have been in his hand.
Yes.
And so he could have just ran barefoot. But again, then anytime you factor in that this is suicide, I guess, you have to then again assume that the fall shattered his shins. I don't know. And I think they were talking a lot about that there's not a lot of access to that roof. So that would be hard for him to even get access.
So what we have here is with the other two locations, again, the parking garage aside, because it doesn't seem that that would have killed Ray.
Right.
But the other location would be from the 11th floor ledge of the Belvedere Hotel. Now, this spot seems to make a little more sense because it puts him much closer to the hole in the rooftop below.
Yeah. And it's enough distance that he could have ran. So whatever speed he would have to get up to make that distance, he could have done.
Yeah. And again, he wouldn't have had to make it out that far of a distance. That's why this spot seems to make a little more sense as far as the math goes. The problem with the 11th floor ledge, and we say ledge, but I mean, you see this on Unsolved Mysteries, and yeah, they're kind of quick to say, hey, it'd be difficult to walk along that ledge. It actually looked like a pretty decent sized ledge to me.
Mm-hmm.
As you pointed out, the problem with the 11th floor ledge and getting to the top of the Belvedere itself is that we don't have anybody who has ever reported to have seen Ray Rivera in the building that night.
Yeah, and where's the cameras? You'd think, you know, this is a hotel that turns into condos. They would have some security. You know a lot about this. I mean, you worked in a high-rise condo facility for a while.
Yeah, I worked in a building that would be, the general description would be the same as what we're talking about here, the Belvedere Hotel. High-rise, yeah. Condominiums, downtown.
And you guys had a lot of cameras.
We had a ton of cameras. I guess the major difference here would be that the building I worked in was built in the late 90s. And as we discussed, this building was built in the early 1900s.
Right.
Now, of course, you come in and you put in those cameras much later. They didn't have security cameras when the building was built, obviously. We don't have anybody that says that they saw Ray Rivera in the building prior to finding him dead in the portion of the building below.
Mm-hmm.
One major problem with that, Captain, is the 11th floor ledge that he would have had to get to. This is privately owned condos. This is not just like some space inside the building where people can get to.
Well, I'd like to know if any of them are connected to his old work.
That is the major question. I think that is the big question that is missing from the Unsolved Mysteries presentation, as well as anything else that I could find. Because the times that I worked in these types of living situations, it was very common for individuals to live in the residential tower and work at buildings within walking distance of the residential tower. These are typically fairly well-to-do people that are working downtown, and they're living and paying that higher cost of living to live there so that they don't have to commute in and out of the city.
Mm-hmm.
That they can, you know what? Oh, it's a nice day. I think I'll just cross the street and go up to the 10th floor to my office. The 11th floor has condos that are owned by individuals. He would have had to have had access by one of those individuals somehow to get out to the ledge.
Mm-hmm.
And then the weirder part is nobody's coming forward saying, yeah, he committed suicide right outside my window.
Yeah, but it could have been like a forced jump situation. Either they're attacking him within a room and he went to escape and this is what happened. Or it was, look, buddy, you're going to go off that ledge and jump for it. And if you don't, we're going to kill your wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could have been that kind of situation. It doesn't. He could have jumped and it still could have been murder. I mean, I think he could have made that distance. I still question injuries to his shin.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also question, was he being beat up by anybody? Was he possibly hit with something? Was there possible fractures and not breaks until the actual jump? If that makes any sense.
Right.
If he's trying to escape, or there's injuries that they can't account for because of the fall or going through the roof, or those because he was being attacked by somebody.
So you brought up the security cameras, and one thing that really upset me when I first started looking into this case is just what upset me when we talked about Jennifer Kessie's case, or, you know, be it a hotel in downtown Chicago. We've covered cases that have that going on. And anytime that we have
Brandon Swanson?
No, he was out in the middle of
Jesse Ross.
Kanika Jenkins. And I mean, there's a good long list of cases that we've discussed that have security cameras involved. And one thing that upset me in some of those cases is that they have no camera footage, yet they have the cameras as fixtures on and inside the buildings. This is a situation where we don't have any camera footage as well. Now, on the surface, most of the reports out there state the same thing, that they were the camera was disconnected, or there was a glitch in the system. That sounds very suspicious. Almost like, oh, we knew we were going to kill him. We knew we were going to throw him off the side of this building. Let's make it so the cameras are not working. After some more digging, what I found was that it was a simple case of, remember, he wasn't found very quickly. He was missing for a week. The way this was all digitized, so the program was set up to record over its old footage at some point.
Mm.
And because they found him within a day, 24 hours, 48 hours, whenever, they likely would have had some kind of footage of what was going on. And we would have very likely a whole different story to tell here in the garage today. But the way that I understand this, Captain, is that it was because he wasn't found for a certain amount of time, that be a week or a little over a week, that the footage was set up. It was predetermined to record over itself, and therefore whatever it captured is just completely lost.
Right.
So that's just, it's unfortunate. And I will say this, you know, because I saw the question come up that says, well, this is just a shame. You know, I could understand it had he been missing for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or 4 weeks, or a month, that they would have recorded over top of it. It's very common in most of the situations I've worked in that the footage is recorded over within a week of itself.
Yeah, because normally if there's a crime, police are pretty quick to go around and collect any footage.
Now, at the places that I've worked, Captain, where there's an abundance of security and security officers, what we would do is actually have someone view the footage before we would record over it. Now, mind you, the person is viewing it at 4 times, 8 times, 16 times the speed. You're really just looking for anything blatantly obvious of something wrong going on.
Yeah, Bigfoot.
Exactly. I mean, it'd be difficult to pay somebody to sit there and watch days and days and days of footage every time you record over it. So I went from being pretty upset, because the thing that I pointed out in Jennifer Kessie's case, along with a lot of these other cases, if you're paying to live there, that's one of the things that's built into your homeowner's fees, to your condo fees, is that they are selling you peace of mind. They are selling you that you live in a secure building.
Okay, so just to go over this real quick. So the parking garage, like I said, I heard the theory about him getting hit by a car and maybe the car launched him. But like you said, there's a wall. There's all these factors. Is it possible? I don't know. If you tried it 100 times, maybe 1 out of 100 it could happen.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't seem likely. And would that be enough force to send him through this roof? The problem also with the roof is we just don't know for certain, because he's also, like you said, he's a tall guy. He's a heavier guy. At what height is that possible? So even though I like that theory, I don't think it's likely. So the parking garage for me just doesn't seem like the most plausible.
Right.
But then even less likely to get to the top of this facility and to jump off or to be pushed off, it doesn't seem like it's that probable. It seems like he would have to be doing a lot of traveling through the air. And because it's so much higher up, it seems like maybe there would be more damage to the body. And then it doesn't make a lot of sense with the cell phone and the flip-flops being found right on top of the roof at that height. Now, if you go down lower, like you were saying, this other ledge, but he'd have to have access through one of the private rooms or private condos. But it does seem possible that's more likely to me, that ledge would be where he came from. And now with the flip-flops and the phone, now hear me out, it could be wrong. I've always thought, well, that seems like maybe that afterwards, did somebody go to the garage, get onto the roof of the building, walk across and look down to see, to make sure he's dead, right? Mm-hmm. And then did they leave those items behind? Or is it possible those items were in his hands, and once he hit the roof, he then loses control of them. And now they're only falling, you know, a couple feet, if that makes sense, as he's going through the roof.
Yeah, so the way that I've always kind of thought about this, and I thought, look, the flip-flops, the eyeglasses, the cell phone to me is not such a big mystery. Because as our cell phones have gotten smarter and more sophisticated, they seem to have gotten more fragile over the years. His cell phone is kind of a plasticky cell phone that I think could take, what do they say, take a licking and keep on ticking.
That's what she said.
I could see the cell phone surviving that fall. The eyeglasses seem a bit strange to me. But
Because there's the eyeglasses are also on the roof as well.
So the people that discredit anybody saying that he could have come off of the parking garage or off of either of those places of the Belvedere rooftop, they say, well, maybe he was pushed out of a helicopter, which I'm not going to lie to you. That mathematically makes some sense because he's then just dropping straight down.
Right. But what eyewitness do we have of a helicopter being in the area?
Well, not only that, then you have a problem here. Like, if he's dropped out of a helicopter, pushed out of a helicopter, he's forced out under that manner. Is he just holding these items? Because people say, well, maybe these items were staged to be there in that location. And the problem is, if you force him off of the ledge at any of these three locations or force him out of a helicopter, then you have to figure out a way to magically place these items so that they fall right near the hole of the roof. That seems difficult, not impossible, but it seems unlikely.
Okay, go back. So what you're saying is if he jumps or you force him out, that if he was holding these items,
if he doesn't have them on his person.
Right.
Because there are people that say, well, maybe these items were staged, that, oh, you know, I gotta get rid of his belongings now, and I want to put them near where they're going to find his body.
Right. It wouldn't be that hard for them to go to the garage and walk on the roof and just place them down.
But that's what I want to know. I want to know, when they say these items were found near the hole in the roof, what is that distance?
Right.
Because if they're saying that they're found within 6 inches of that 40-inch diameter hole, that's pretty damn close.
Yeah, and I also,
if they're found just on some, you know, anywhere on the rooftop, then whatever. Anybody could have just tossed them from anywhere and they landed there.
Well, I'd also want to know, like, we have the flip-flops, the glasses, the cell phone that we find on the roof. Do we find other items that are around his person in the room?
No, it seems like the only things that were reported to be questionable were these items that were found on the roof itself before he crashed through. It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold, hard cash sitting on the table unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that can bring out everyone's most devious selves. And Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic game that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties. Bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play. Have you ever thought about why your wireless bill is so damn expensive? It's all just radio waves. And how much can radio waves really cost? It seems like big wireless all got together and decided $100 a month. Now, thanks to Mint Mobile, you have a choice. For a limited time, all phone plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plan's jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. So ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get premium wireless for just $15 a month. I love Mint Mobile. They have great quality. They have wonderful service. I love saving money. Put them together and I'm getting great quality, great service, a wonderful phone plan for only $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Factor's ready to eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff. Customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. They're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Day Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. I am always on the go. I'm rather busy. And grabbing a quick meal, for me, used to mean eating the bad stuff. But I've switched to Factor. Now I simply grab a Factor meal from my refrigerator, heat, and then I am enjoying a delicious meal in just 2 minutes. And it's not loaded with the bad stuff. Head to factormeals.com/TrueCrimeGarage50 and use code TrueCrimeGarage50. To get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month, that's code TrueCrimeGarage50 at factormeals.com/TrueCrimeGarage50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All right, cheers, you animals. True crime animals.
True crime animals. All right, we have a note to talk about here, Captain.
Yeah.
And this is a weird one, and certainly one of the more weird aspects of this entire case, in my opinion. And that is that a note was found taped to the back of Ray Rivera's computer. And the way that this is described was that Angel, his brother, and Allison, his wife, found this note taped to the back of his computer after Ray disappeared.
Yeah, but it was almost like he took a bunch of pages and shrunk them down into one.
Yeah, the description I would provide for this note, for those who have not seen it, it appears that it's printed off on his computer, and it looks like it's three different columns, and that he put it in the smallest font he possibly could to fit all three columns, which in themselves would be three different pages on one single page. And then he seems to have gone around and cut the edges, the blank edges off of the paper to make the paper itself even smaller, and then folds it up and puts it into a plastic bag or some form of plastic and tapes it to the back of his computer. Now, you know, there's a lot of things that you can question in this case, and this note is very bizarre. I really do not know how to take this note or how to feel about it. I will say that the things that were written on the note itself, it does appear to me, for as an outsider looking in, that this was authored by Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And Allison would go on to tell us that she believes that it was written and printed the day that he went missing, because she found the cutaway edges of the piece of paper in the trash can. But again, this note folded up and taped to the back of the computer. And we should also mention that along with the note, they found a blank check from his video production company. Now, the general description of this note is that it is a confusing note that included the names of prominent figures in Hollywood, Freemasonry quotations, and additional ramblings. The FBI analyzed this note, and according to the retired detective interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries, he says the FBI ruled that the note was not suicidal in nature. I have seen it noted that the FBI may have deemed the note to be the delusional ramblings of someone in the throes of a psychotic break.
I think there's a lot of people that keep notes to themselves. Like, you know, I have notes that I put in my phone that if you saw them, you'd be like, what the heck is this? One of them is just like a list of song titles. So if you went through the list and you start going, you know, Lonely Forever, the next song, Zombie Pills, you would start reading the list going, what the heck is this? This sounds like he lost his mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the location of where they find the note adds to the mystery of it. Because now this man mysteriously disappears. His wife says that she cannot explain nor understand his death. And then we have this note that's taped to the back of his computer screen. I get what you're saying, and that's what my mind immediately went to in my own personal life of notes that I take, be it on my computer, in my phone, on scraps of paper, in notebooks. But that's in notebooks and on scraps of paper. You know what I mean? It's like if you bury it in the backyard and it's later found, or you put it up in your attic or tape it to your ceiling or behind your computer screen, it takes on a different meaning.
Yeah,
in some way. It's like, why did he go to the effort to print it in this manner, trim away the edges, cover it up in plastic, include a blank check with it, and then tape it to the back of the computer? It's one of those weird things where it's like, did he do that because he wanted it to be found but not so easily found? And if it is just the ramblings of a creative mind who's saving ideas or creating ideas and logging them for later use, it also, again, it seems like a strange place to...
Yeah, but there's also a section where it's a list of a bunch of people he knew as well.
Well, I think we should probably go through what is believed to be on this letter.
Yeah, and we'll say that because if you're looking, I'll post a couple of the pictures that I found online, but all you're seeing is like the note from a distance, and like Nick was saying, the font is so small that you can't even make out anything. So it's kind of interesting because this case I've talked about was on Unsolved Mysteries, was requested so highly from the listeners for us to go over it as well. And there's really normally a famous note like this, it would be all over the internet and be documented and diagrammed out.
Don't you kind of question the note even more because they've chosen not to do that?
Yeah, that's a good point.
It seems a bit weird that Allison, look, and she is very level-headed because I've seen interviews with her where she says, all I'm asking is that this be looked at and that people investigate his death, because I think we've gone through so much minutia in this case that we probably forgot to mention that the police deemed this to be a suicide. They say we don't have all the answers, but they say what we have found, we don't have any reason to believe that anything other than suicide took place here.
Well, and back to his wife, Allison, very smart. You can tell she's very intelligent. So, but why wouldn't she want to put out the note?
Right. And her exact words from an interview that I saw with her, she says, all I'm asking is that people take another look at this, that police and investigators take another look at this for my sake and for the family's sake and for Ray's sake. And she's saying, look, if you decide upon further investigation that it was in fact suicide, I'm fine with that. I just want to feel good and have some peace of mind about the answers I'm getting. And she does not have that right now.
Well, and I,
so then that makes me, sorry to cut you off, but it makes me question it further. Then why is this note not more readily available? Right. Mm-hmm. Because I can't find it anywhere.
And you're good at computers and you normally find things.
What I can find is pictures of this note. And what I can find are people who have tried to transcribe the note best they can from blurry images of the note, mm-hmm. or by watching Unsolved Mysteries and hitting pause on the screen and trying to make out what they see there. So when we go through what this note says, keep in mind, we can't say 100% that this is in fact the exact words, word for word, of what the note says.
Well, I was just going to say, a lot of people are very quick to rule out a possible suicide. We have an individual that moved him and his wife across the country for opportunity that obviously didn't work out. Or maybe he felt like he didn't let the situation work out because it wasn't a good fit for him. And then he was doing some other stuff. But when you have to start a company by borrowing a bunch of money, one of the number one reasons for suicide, especially in males, is financial. So it's just not out of the realm of possibilities when people say, oh, well, my brother would never do that, or my friend would never do that, or my husband would never do that. That happens a lot of times in suicides, you know, sadly enough. But it's not out of the realm of possibility.
Captain, I'm going to go through this letter a little bit, and I'm not going to necessarily go through every single word because people can look this up. And I think that if we really tried to analyze this down to every sentence and every word, we would be doing another 4 or 5 episodes on Ray's case.
Hey, I'm down.
So again, this is what people have interpreted this letter to say. Brothers and sisters, right now around the world, volcanoes are erupting. What an awesome sight. Then next we have a Masonic quote, again, more of the Freemason stuff. And then that's followed by, that was a well-played game. Congratulations to all who participated. I hope you enjoyed it. But it is time to wake up, so here I am. I'd like to welcome those who accepted our invitations for membership during the game. We couldn't have done it without you. I took on this endeavor to find the truth, but not for its own sake in accepting this quest for truth. I hoped to make myself, with the help of others, into a man worthy and ready to receive it. Members of the council, please note that I will lend careful consideration to the traditional responsibilities in light of these proceedings, and I will satisfy the standard request of this council, within the appropriate time. Again, well done to all who participated. I expect the council has invited all the players who have gave their lives to this pursuit back so they might join us here. Again, we have no idea what he could be talking about. Join us here. Join us where?
Well, and it could, because he writes scripts. It could be just jotting down an idea for a monologue in a movie.
Yeah, and it goes on to say something like, before I continue with my instructions for the council and claim the prize for my service, I'd like to allow Porter Stansberry to claim his prize. The next couple sentences, it's not clear. A lot of the words are kind of missing. I'm going to jump over that a little bit. But at some point, it's thought that he's saying something to the effect of, now that the game is finished, I expect the council to blank. Most people think he's saying reward those who have given what might be time and talent to this venture. Along with myself, these players should be made 5 years younger by the council. And then it's a long list of names, and you can actually, you can find this in two versions. You can find a small blurry version, or you can find a bigger version where the last names are redacted, but it's a long list of names.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, any thoughts so far on what we've gone through?
No, keep going.
Okay. I'm going to offer up some of mine right here, because I don't know what this council is that he's talking about, but he keeps referencing the game.
Right.
It seems a little weird to me that he is, there seems to be some kind of prize or reward that should be given to himself and to these other people. And one thing that I find very interesting is that the reward that he is saying that these people should get is to be made 5 years younger by the council.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning the list of names that follow that, because it is a reward, these must be people that he deems to be good people or deserving of a reward. And going through this list, one name that I did find on there is Frank Stansberry, which we said at the beginning of yesterday's episode that his friend, his longtime friend's name is Frank Porter Stansberry. So again, kind of going back to the idea that a lot of people are suspicious of this Porter guy, but if he is in fact referencing his friend Frank Porter Stansberry as Frank Stansberry in this portion of the letter, it's almost like Ray is saying he's a good guy. He's deserving of some type of reward for his effort, for his time, for his talents, for his good deeds, maybe. But then where that becomes a problem is, several times in this same note or letter, whatever you want to call it, he refers to this man as Porter Stansberry. So then you have to wonder, is Frank Porter Stansberry's father, does he have the same name? And is Ray then rewarding somebody else? You know, why would you refer to somebody a couple of times as Porter Stansberry, but then later as Frank Stansberry?
Yeah, well, what's also weird, because he lists the game as in the section where he's listing movies. That's the, I believe it's David Fincher,
mm-hmm.
The David Fincher movie. But what's weird is, and this I think has been kind of blown up through Reddit, is the main character in the game dies in a similar fashion.
Michael Douglas.
He dies from jumping from the roof of the building through a glass ceiling.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen that movie.
1997.
I actually recall the movie different than that, that there is several scenes of somebody committing suicide by jumping off of a rooftop. I don't recall it being, who is that? Michael Douglas or John Douglas? I get the two father and son confused.
I think it's Michael.
Yeah. So a lot of people have referenced that. Is he talking about the game? And then they take it a step further of, was somebody playing a game on him? Was he involved in some kind of game?
Well, the idea is in 1997, the film follows a man who participates in a scheme which blurs his concept of reality and ends with him jumping from the roof of a building through a glass ceiling.
So in the movie, he's like extremely wealthy, and it's what do you give the man who has everything for his birthday? You give him an experience, and the experience is given to him, I believe, by his brother, which then drives him to insanity because it's just, it's an insane movie, really. I actually feel like if we are going to put meaning to these words and try to decipher what he means here, mm-hmm. I almost feel like the game, it's like he's referencing his life and life being a game.
Right.
And so that's where I think it's weird that the FBI, again, we're not hearing this from the FBI. We're hearing it from a retired detective who says the FBI said they don't believe the note to be suicidal in nature. I actually go the opposite way, and I'm of course no expert, but I go the opposite way, and I see a note here that looks to me.
Well, how many shows do you have to do until we start just calling you an expert?
It looks to me like it is suicidal in nature. But it's like,
I could see that.
You know what I mean? It's like he's thanking the people that were involved in his game, and the game being his life. And I wonder, is there something, a major event that we are unaware of that took place within a few years or up to 5 years before Ray's death? Because the choosing of these players should be made 5 years younger by the council seems awfully specific.
It's a very strange line.
Right. Did he lose his father? Did he lose somebody important to him?
Mm-hmm.
One quote that I love, and this is an old George Clooney quote, is that the greatest gift that we can give the ones that we love is time. And I find that to be such an interesting quote because it's coming from somebody who's pretty darn wealthy and could give anybody that he wants a bunch of money. And he's right. Time is one hell of a gift. Mm-hmm. And here we got Ray referencing, not that quote, but he states something very similar with a long list of people that he obviously cares about. Because the people that are included at the top of this list, we have his brother, his father, his mother, his wife, his sister. So these are clearly people that he is listing that he loves, that he says he believes deserve some type of reward for their participation and their time in the game. He goes on to list a whole bunch of like inventions and innovations that came about since his game began. And then he goes on into some weird business about the patents and proceeds from all of these items that he lists should somehow be transferred to him. And he references several different homes in different countries and continents that he can be found in at some point. And after that, it's another list of movies that he really likes, saying, I would love to meet any of you who helped contribute to these works. And he lists many movies, all of them, you know, they're interesting movies, not just The Game, but you have Seven and National Treasure, The Da Vinci Code, The Matrix 1, 2, and 3, so on and so forth. In a specific reference to M. Night Shyamalan.
Mm. Old Shyamalan.
And then he goes on to say, I'd also like to single out, and there's a name of somebody. Again, we have Porter, his name referenced a couple of times in this letter, and I really can't make heads or tails of this letter, Captain. I don't, and I think that this letter makes this story that much more confusing, and the case that much more confusing, because what is this letter in itself?
Well, and like we said, let's just hypothetically say the Freemason stuff, or he started doing research for ideas for screenplays. People that are creative can get wrapped up into that. And we have evidence of maybe that turning into reality by not wanting his wife to, you know, go somewhere, thinks people are breaking into his house, or at least alarms going off in his house. Is it possible there was something going on with inside his brain that his friends and family just weren't aware of?
And that's why I keep going back to this idea of, if he is truly afraid of something, why is he not telling people in his life, even on the DL, look, I'm worried about this situation. I'm specifically worried about this whole thing right here. Especially his wife, who he seems to be concerned of her safety as well. And then this note is left. But what is the purpose of this note? Is it meant to be a warning? I'm getting at. It's not obvious that it's a suicide note. That's clear.
Well, and there's a lot of actors that have done big movies, and then those movies are connected to the FBI or the CIA, and then there's a lot of conspiracy theorists that go, oh, well, see, they had Matt Damon do the Jason Bourne movies, and then they bring him into the fold, and so he actually is a government agent now. And there's all weird conspiracies of that nature. And I just wonder, all these notes are, again, for some big movie, and he's referencing all these movies he likes and wants to be inspired by this list of movies. And here's all these actors that he thinks could play in the movies that would understand the inner workings of a movie that was based around the Freemasons or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, you could compile this whole thing that seems like a crazy thing and just go, this is a web. When you're trying to create something as big as a movie, you're thinking about characters, you're thinking about their backstory, you're thinking about monologues that could be said in the movie, you're thinking about sets and tones, and it could just be a list of movies that he likes the tone in them. You know, if you watch Good Will Hunting, for example, and you realize Gus Van Sant uses, it's all like autumn colors. The whole movie is the list of movies, just stuff he likes about the way it was shot or the directors. If you put it in that context, it's like, well, it all makes sense. It could just be research for a movie.
Right. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at here is that the people that point out that this letter means something, I put a big question mark on that. It very likely could mean nothing at all, as you're pointing out. Or how do we go and look at this and go, oh, of course, he knew that somebody was going to kill him, or he knew that he was in deep trouble, and so he left this cryptic letter, taped it to the back of his computer as a warning to everybody else, or as a, hey, this is what happened to me. But nobody can figure out or make heads or tails of this letter. Well, so it didn't. If that was the purpose of it, he didn't do a very good job of explaining that to anybody. You see what I mean? Like it to argue that this letter is proof that he was in trouble and people were after him, I think that's a hard argument to make when it's not a clear warning, and it's not a clear arrow pointing to who did him harm.
Yeah, and again, this is, I mean, sounds like a crazy theory, but I don't know the character of Ray because I wasn't friends with him. They didn't show like a bunch of clips of this guy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Was he a gullible guy or not? Is it possible that he moves out here, is not connecting well with friends, and he's a little gullible, and he's talking about some movie he wants to make, some conspiracy movie, and then his friends decide to play a trick on him? It, just like the game, right? I don't understand why his friend backed away like he did. It seems like if it was suicidal, or if he thought that there was something going on with his friend mentally, that he would have stuck around and answered as many questions as possible.
I also think that if it was suicide, that maybe this letter is kind of a cryptic way of leaving some kind of note. But again, it's just not obvious. So either there was no intent or with this letter itself, or it's lost on us. If you're going to point to this letter and then say this letter points more towards suicide, that's when I say, I think this letter points more towards there was some kind of psychotic break in this young man, and he lost it, and he chose to take his life when his wife was not in town. People have said, well, he would have had to have known that Belvedere Hotel. He would have had to have some kind of understanding, and he wouldn't have because he was not from there. He was from out of town. And that's where I take it a step further, and I go, I don't know that, that is the case. I mean, I think a big problem with this mystery is that it was so long between the time he went missing to the time that he was found. Mm-hmm. If he chose to take his own life and chose to purposely not do that at his home so that his poor wife wouldn't then later find his body, maybe he thought he was jumping into a place that would put him in, you know, right out there for somebody to find him almost immediately so she wouldn't have to come home and find him. But he just didn't know that building and didn't know that he was landing and crashing through into a space that was, for the most part, unused.
Right. Or did he assume he would go through the roof?
Yeah. Did he make a mistake and think that he was going to land on the street?
Yeah.
I do want to go through something else here, Captain, real quick. And this is from the Baltimore Sun newspaper, Thursday, August 6th of this year. And this is in response to the release of the Ray Rivera episode on Unsolved Mysteries. And I'm just going to read a few selected paragraphs from this, but I ask that you bear with me. This article includes an interview with Porter Stansberry, as well as an interview with the author that wrote the book about the unexplained death, The Body at the Belvedere. But it also includes a second friend of Ray's, and his name is Brad Hopman, who said that he knew Ray Rivera since childhood and remained close with him up to his death. He also believes the story has been twisted. Quote, "This is a real conversation the world can have about mental illness and help people get help when they need it," end quote. He goes on to say, "And it turned into a murder mystery where they're accusing people of being involved." Later in the article, Stansberry says he has received death threats and his family has been harassed online. He said he's even been questioned by friends and potential business partners. Stansberry says, quote, "It's horrific. You can't even imagine what it's like to tell people I had nothing to do with my friend's death." And then we have, when Ray Rivera went missing, Stansberry said he hired a private investigator, offered a reward, and personally helped look for Rivera. Once the body was found, Stansberry said, "We were all sad and shocked by the fact that Ray killed himself. But once we saw all the facts and his financial pressures, it wasn't much of a mystery." In the show, retired Baltimore homicide detective Michael Baer and Rivera's wife say that after Rivera's body was found, Stansberry refused to return calls from investigators and put out a, quote, gag order on employees to keep them from talking. Stansberry says, quote, "It's a complete lie. It's not a matter of opinion. It's a lie." He said only the employees were told to refer media inquiries to a spokesperson.
Right, which you've said is very common.
He said he personally spoke with a detective on June 23rd, 2006. So where this gets a little convoluted is, remember, this is after Detective Baer was moved to another division. So on Unsolved Mysteries, Detective Baer saying, "This man Stansberry wouldn't talk to me." Stansberry saying, "I did speak to a detective. It was just a different detective."
Right.
Baer was moved, and it's not any type of conspiracy, because Baer did, he says, "Look, I did not agree with the police findings that this was suicide." And I think there's a good amount of questions here. So I applaud him for going the extra mile to really get to the bottom of this, but it's not a conspiracy that he went against the grain and got moved to another division. He requested to be moved to this new task force that had formed. And the way that those things generally work is you apply for a position or a department change, and it takes some time for that to go in effect. So he gets moved. Now we have later in the article where Alison Rivera has said the call came from, this is the last phone call. The call came from the switchboard of Agora Publishing, and the specific caller could not be determined. Agora, a global publishing company headquartered in Baltimore, has several subsidiary companies, including Stansberry's, and at the time, all calls were routed through a main switchboard. A police spokeswoman on Tuesday, this would have been August 4th of this year, said the call came from an owned subsidiary company of Agora Publishing. So when you read reports that say it came from Stansberry and Associates, that's not what the police's position is publicly on this. They're not saying it didn't come from Stansberry Associates. They're just saying it came from a subsidiary of this parent company.
Mm-hmm. So his friend talks to law enforcement. He gets a detective to look for his friend. He puts up a reward. Now you have this other friend coming out saying that Ray had some mental health issues. But couldn't he still figure out who made the call to Ray and what that call was about?
Yeah.
Because I also think when he talks about these financial pressures, he would know more than anybody because he's the one that had his friend come out there. And so he gets there and it's not working out. But was it not working out even more than we're led on to believe? Because we also don't have records and or statements of all there was all this credit card debt and there were student loans and there was the house, they were upside down on the mortgage. We just don't have any reports of that.
Right. We just have this Stansberry character saying this publicly all these years later. They haven't been in their house very long, so I couldn't imagine that they had much in the way of equity. And I've seen many references to Allison's and Ray's financials online.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where those statements and reports are coming from, so I don't care to bother to report them here because it could just be some twerp in his basement typing that up and putting it out as fact.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it published anywhere by anybody that's credible. The article, though, cites a lot of really interesting things, and if I can, I'll continue here. If you'll allow me, I'll continue a little bit longer. It says Stansberry said that Ray Rivera had also asked him previously if he was in leadership of the Freemasons, which Stansberry said he thought was a joke. He said when Rivera's family and friends were searching for him, Rivera's wife told him that the Saturday before he went missing, Ray was morose and would not get out of bed. She told me she was very worried about his mental state at the time he disappeared. Stansberry said, quote, "I'm not the only friend Ray approached and said these things that were very odd." Now, back to the other friend, the second friend that we referenced earlier, Brad Hopman, Ray's childhood friend, said not long before his death, Ray repeatedly asked him about being a member of the Freemasons and discussing the film Eyes Wide Shut. Hopman, who also worked for Stansberry at one time, but says they were not close, said the week before his death, Rivera asked to be able to visit his top floor apartment in Jersey City. Rivera had a key to the place, but then returned it. Said, quote, "He was acting really, really weird." That is a quote from Brad Hopman. In a separate interview that I read with employees and people that worked with this Porter Stansberry.
Yeah.
They said that it was pretty common for Porter, who, as you pointed out earlier, is pretty successful. It was pretty standard practice for him to hire people that necessarily didn't have a background for the position that he was offering them, but they were people that he knew for most of his life.
Right.
And that it was people that he trusted. You know, he needed to put these people in a position of trust where they would have his back, he would have theirs, and therefore he valued that trust level more than them being educated or experienced in that specific area of work.
Right.
One thing that I found really interesting, and this goes along with some of the opinions, be it yours and mine, that we have shared throughout the years in regards to the Brian Schaefer case. Listen closely. Brotman. Remember, Brotman is the author of the 2018 book about Rivera's death. She was a resident of the Belvedere. Mm-hmm. She said that the Netflix show interviewed her for hours and that she told them the roof was easily accessible, not at all difficult to reach as the show asserted.
Mm-hmm.
In her book, she explores the various theories and concludes that Rivera likely had a mental break and jumped from the roof. She says, quote, "I think if they'd included my interviews, it would have closed down a lot of the speculation because it would have been obvious that a lot of avenues and angles had already been explored at length," end quote. Stansberry said the case is being sensationalized. Quote, "I think what's really sad about this is there are people in Hollywood who would do anything to craft a story to get attention, even when it comes to destroying someone's reputation and trying to sensationalize the tragedy of a death of a 32-year-old man," end quote. I find that awfully interesting that we have the woman that wrote a book about this case that lives in the building and says, you know what, she's saying they kind of conveniently left out my interviews because I was saying it was easy for someone to access the roof.
Well, just like I've told you, when I went and interviewed all those security guards at the Ugly Tuna, and they go, of course there's blind spots and he could have got out of here without being on camera.
Yeah.
And you go, well, why has it been reported for the last 5 years or 10 years or whatever that it was impossible? It's because it makes it a better story. It's a little more juicy.
So you have here a situation, and one thing I want to point out too, remember we said that when they transferred the Belvedere Hotel, when it went from being a hotel to being renovated into condominiums.
Hotel, motel.
That there were still some portions of the building that were not privately owned. You know, these are common spaces and some spaces that were, in fact, open to the public.
Right.
The Belvedere Hotel, as it's oddly called even all these years later, has a space that is called the 13th floor. Well, it's kind of a famous bar. So it's open to the public for people to go up all the way up to be at the 13th floor and have some cocktails and drinks up there. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not too many floors far away from either the top or the 11th floor ledge where it's believed that he would have had to have jumped. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a weird situation of what the story is kind of missing that we're hoping to fill in here is that, one, yes, the rooftop and the ledge were probably more likely accessible than what we have a standard, you know, than what we have an understanding of so far. So what it sounds like here, Captain, is that the areas where he possibly could have jumped from were easily accessible.
Mm-hmm.
That there is a reasonable explanation why the security footage does not exist to this day. And we have engineers who say that it is physically and mathematically possible for somebody to make it out that far horizontally if they're traveling at a speed that is easily attained by a man who's in good physical condition.
Mm-hmm.
So I rule on the side, and well, I lean on the side of suicide here, unfortunately, with Ray Rivera's case. The question I still have at the end of the day, even with these answers that we've tried to provide, is why do we have a situation where no one has ever come forward and said, I was the person that called Ray on that day that he disappeared?
I think one of the reasons why people have a hard time believing this is suicide is because there wasn't a lot of signs of depression. And so normally when people think of suicides, they think of that the individual was depressed. Again, is it possible that he was having some kind of mental break and not seeing things as clearly as he once did?
Whatever happened to Ray was obviously very tragic, and it's a horrible story to have to tell. It's a horrible case to have to try to sift through and make heads or tails of what possibly happened to this young man who had his whole life ahead of him and, as said, was loved by everyone around him. Again, Captain, my question goes to, if these other persons who are saying we believe this was a suicide, we're backing the police's theory of suicide, this is what was going on in Ray's life at the time, and it's a sad situation that we cannot have a discussion about mental health, about mental illness, and work toward helping people. Again, why do we not have the person coming forward and saying, I was the person that called Ray that afternoon on May 16th.
Seems like everybody has an opinion or a theory about this case. If you have one, go to truecrimegarage.com and leave that for us on the blog. Colonel, do we have any recommended reading for this week?
Let's do some recommended listening there, Captain. It's a good week, I think, to go check out some good music, and you can do that by checking out the Captain's music at CaptainFatHands.com or go to TrueCrimeGarage.com and click on the Captain's anchor. Anchors away there, Captain.
I also have a comedy CD coming out. It's called I Have a Lot of Jokes, But I Don't Know If My Co-Host Is Listening.
All right, join us back here in the garage next week. Until then, be good, be kind, and don't litter.